Our guest today is Stephen Lenman, and he is the editor of an important new book, Flashpoint in Ukraine, How the U.S. Drive for Hegemony Risks World War III. Welcome to the program, Stephen.
Oh, thank you, Phil. Good to be on with you.
I have to say that this is the old cliche that your book is sort of torn from today's headlines. The headline in The Guardian reads, Ukraine clashes have leaves several dead and test Trump's Russian stance. And as well, in today's Globe and Mail, our national paper, the editors are advising that more soldiers, Canadian, be sent to Ukraine as a way to help. And I don't know. Tell your book, Flashpoint in Ukraine, would argue that both these headlines and the themes are somewhat off point. Tell us where this problem comes from. How are we in a situation where people are talking about sending more Canadian troops because of some little violence in Ukraine today?
Well, the violence was instigated by the government against people in the southeast of the country, Phil, what I call the Donbas area of Ukraine, and the people who are resisting the tyranny in Kiev, the capital of Ukraine. I call them freedom fighters because that's exactly what they are. They refuse to live under a fascist dictatorship, which was what Washington installed in Ukraine. This is what the Obama administration did in February 2014. The legitimate government, which was far from perfect, it was pretty abysmal, as a matter of fact, under President Yanukovych. Second time he'd been president, there was a revolution. There was an orange revolution against him, I believe, in 2004, and his replacement. I forget the president's name who took his place, installed by Washington, by the Bush people. A name very similar to Yanukovych, but not quite the same. But he was Washington's man in Kiev, and conditions were so abysmal in the country that there was an election in 2010, and Yanukovych won the election to come back into power. He should have used his office more responsibly than he did. He was a setup to really let America come back in again and instigate a coup against him, which is what happened. It began in late 2013, culminating in February 2014, where under the direction of Assistant Secretary of State Victoria Nuland, a neocon in the Obama administration.
Yes. By the way, just to come in here, your book, the writers take up this role, and people really need to be reminded how overtly the Americans involved themselves. They were glad to be seen, Senator McCain, and also the liberal Democrat from Massachusetts. But Victoria Nuland, she set some sort of record for butting into a country's business, didn't she?
Oh, she really did, and she has a notorious record. She was a member of she was an aide to Dick Cheney way back in the Bush administration. And I mean, her resume, I wrote about it. It's been a good while. I'd have to go back and look at it to see all of the dark spots on it. But just an abysmal record. And yet, Hillary Clinton picked her. Hillary Clinton, the Secretary of State, picked her. And heaven knows if Hillary had won, maybe Victoria Nuland would have become Secretary of State. Oh, my God, absolutely an abomination. The Ukrainian person I couldn't think of, his name was Yushchenko, Yanukovych Yushchenko. They almost sounded alike. He was Washington's man. They put him in, and now they've got this guy, Poroshenko.
The chocolate king.
Petro Poroshenko, the so-called chocolate king, a billionaire. Well, I guess a billionaere. Well, that could be. It certainly isn't an attribute, and in his case, it's absolutely a detriment. And he went to war. The coup installed. They staged an election after the coup, and he basically was an appointed president by Washington, an illegitimate government, a putschist government. It's illegitimate, absolutely Nazi infested, and that's no exaggeration, with extremist elements infesting the government, infesting the country, committing grievous human rights abuses against Ukrainian people. And the economic agenda is right out of the playbook of the IMF, inflicting enormous harm on the Ukrainian people, deep poverty, jobless, unemployment, and the rest of it. Just a horrible situation. I mean, it's being set up for another coup to get somebody else in and get these people out. But what Trump should responsibly do is not support these people. He's got to know. He's got to be briefed. I mean, if I know that a putschist government is running Ukraine and he's the president and he doesn't know this, then he's got no right being president.
Yes.
He's got to know it. But I was very disturbed by a comment by his new UN envoy, Nikki Haley, the former governor of South Carolina. She's very new in the job, just a few days into it. Mm-hmm. And she made a comment that the Trump administration respects the sovereignty and territorial integrity of Ukraine. I mean, that sounds to me like an endorsement of the fascist regime, and that bothers me a great deal.
It's very worrying. And by the way, again, I'll just tell our listeners, this book is Flashpoint in Ukraine, How the U.S. Drive for Hegemony Risks World War III. And as you're outlining, if the rhetoric from Washington follows along the lines of that new ambassador, the risk of war is very great. I suppose we have to point out that watching Trump, the major thing with him that has seemed to have got everybody steamed, particularly the Democrats, is that he said, I would like to have a different relationship with Russia. But this book actually underlines that would be changing a policy that is, I think you say, goes back at least almost 100 years. Could you talk about how hard it would be to turn that war machine around?
Oh, it would be so very, very hard, Phil. U.S. adversarial relations toward Russia goes back to the 1917 revolution, when the Tsar was overthrown and the Bolsheviks took over the country. And most people don't even know that back in the days of Woodrow Wilson as America's president, he sent U.S. Marines into Russia, coming into the northern part of Russia in an attempt to overthrow the government and install a government that Washington would support. The attempt failed, and I forget how long the Marines stayed there. Mm-hmm. It might have been so many thousands of Marines, not a massive force, but maybe 6,000-8,000 Marines came in, mm-hmm. and it didn't get the job done. I mean, the new government survived. They had their own difficulties with one group of elements battling with the other, and the Bolsheviks finally won. But at the same time,
that was when Churchill said they should have strangled Bolshevism in its cradle.
I think something like that, exactly, Phil. And they
what
didn't
a warm
do that.
Thought.
Lenin wasn't the bad guy. Stalin was the bad guy. When Stalin came into power and Lenin passed from the scene, that's when things really got nasty. But Russia didn't attack anybody. I mean, they certainly controlled what they called the near abroad, because it was the Russian Empire with all these countries that are now independent surrounding Russia to the west of Russia. All these countries are independent now, mm-hmm. including in World War II, Russia took half of Poland, Hitler took the other half, but the Baltic states, Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia—they were Russian. They were Russian provinces, and now they're independent. And others too. Some of the countries we call the Stans countries. Some of them, Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan. I got to have the names in front of me to pronounce
Mr.
them
Stans.
Correctly.
Yes.
Yeah. Some of them are independent, but some of them must. A part of the Western sphere of influence. Mm-hmm. And this was just devastating. I think Russians look back at that period of time where Gorbachev cut a deal with George H.W. Bush.
Let me ask you about that, because that is another striking feature of how this unfolded. The Gorbachev story, which he tells himself, that they had the meetings and they began to dismantle what was called the Soviet Union. And he had the assurance of Reagan and of James Baker, Secretary of State, I think. And that was that, of course, One of the blessings of this was there was going to, remember the word peace dividend? And it wasn't going to be a NATO expansion toward Russia. And under shortly later, after, under Clinton more than Reagan, they began to expand toward the east. But one of your authors points out in this book, Flashpoint in Ukraine, edited by Stephen Nunman, that unfortunately, and this is really kind of almost a mystery to me, they never got this in writing. There was no treaty.
And, it should have been.
I mean, Gorbachev, I hate to say it, but seems to have almost invited them to walk right over him.
He got snookered. He really did.
Snookered is a good expression.
Yeah, I think they shouldn't have trusted. He shouldn't have trusted. Nobody in Russia should have trusted America then, even though it's so much worse now.
By the way, it's supposed to be a country that suspects is reading Professor McMurtry, who is, by the way, from Guelph. He says that they always call the Russians paranoid and suspicious. Well, that wasn't exactly a paranoid and suspicious bit of behavior. He actually made a friendship agreement with the United States, didn't get it in writing.
That's right. And I think he looks back at that period of time and realizes he made a terrible mistake. I just wrote about him saying the world is heading toward World War III. He's well up in years now. He's 86 years old. He was a much younger man back then. But he cut a deal in good faith, and America betrayed him. He should have realized that going back to the 1917 revolution, America betrayed Russia over and over again. You simply cannot trust America. It makes deals and then breaches them. So the other side keeps its word, and America doesn't. And I quoted Sergei Lavrov after Trump came into office, saying Russia is under no illusion that everything is going to go smoothly and we'll have rapprochement with America. I mean, he was very pointed in his comment, and I think that's very much the case with Lavrov, the foreign minister, mm-hmm. and Vladimir Putin. I mean, they'll do what they can in normalizing relations with America, knowing full well that whatever is agreed on could just come crumbling apart, and of course there'll be another president one day after Trump, whenever that is, mm-hmm. and whatever Trump institutes, even if they could does good things, everything could come apart after that. You simply can't trust America. It's been an imperialist throughout its entire history since George Washington. If the country didn't expand from sea to shining sea by being good guys, I mean, they massacred the entire native population,
yes.
almost 98% of them, something like that.
Yeah, and, well, by the way, you, again, one of your authors quotes George Kennan, who is called the, I guess, the father of the containment policy.
Yes.
Containing something that didn't need containing. But I was struck by the quotes, and again, I really recommend people get this book, but where Kennan is very cold-blooded. He says, we're not going to do this because we're nice. We should even forget about being nice, and this is not about democracy. This is about containing.
Yes, that was my chapter, by the way.
Yeah, but, oh, well, I'm happy to quote you then. This is, we're speaking to Stephen Lenman, right? I don't want
to. He was a dove, Phil.
You're going to make sure I get the right author this time.
I had a few chapters in the book myself. That was one of them.
Well, before we go back to Kennan, let me just tell our listeners, too, that you can go to sjlenman.blogspot.ca for. Daily, very helpful assessments of crises around the world, and that's sjlenman.blogspot.com.
Or a simpler way to go is simply to Google Steve Lenman, L-E-N-D-M-A-N, which is the way I access it, and anybody can add. I put new articles up every day.
We're in this new age where I'm still, you know, I'm quoting things in the New York Times trying to get the page number, and you're quite right. All you have to do is just put the guy's name in, never mind the first name, and you get it. But it's Stephen Lenman, and you did make the point. I mean, Kennan was absolutely cold-blooded. And that is, it seems to me, that is the profile you want to understand about policymakers in Washington.
Yeah, that's very true. And again, I would emphasize that he was very dovish compared to most of the people around today, and he was very cold-blooded. And he wrote his ideas at a time that America was supremely dominant after World War II, where it had no competition. I mean, there's no such thing as a trade deficit. It was America made everything and exported it to other countries, and now it's completely the reverse of it. But he argued that to maintain U.S. supremacy, it can't be a good guy. It has to be very cold-blooded about the way it does things. And mm-hmm. this George Kennan, I mean, you can imagine the way people operate today.
Mm-hmm. And again, the book is Flashpoint Ukraine. I want to keep reminding everybody, edited by Stephen Lenman. As he said, by the way, just Google it and get yourself a copy. Let's go back. Just the two questions that in the book treats them both very in great detail, so people would really benefit. The coup that occurred, that was so nakedly clear and to be a coup, and yet no one uses the term coup to describe what happened in February 2014, and that was a negotiated agreement. The president met with the opposition. The dignitaries from the EU were present, and they signed a reasonable way to solve the violence and sort of social tumult going on in the country, egged on by Ms. Newman. But it was a coup, wasn't it? I mean, why wouldn't we, and if we're going to solve this present crisis, wouldn't we have to go back and say, you haven't had an agreement, just observe it, and you could probably have a peaceful country?
Well, if I was the president of the United States, I would point blank explain what happened in Ukraine. I might not last long doing the things that I would do, Phil, but yeah. I would explain there was a coup and the government there is illegitimate, and the United States will no longer recognize it, let alone provide it military aid and all the rest, which is what Obama was doing after the coup. But the coup was instigated, the legitimate government was overthrown, and the putschist government was put in its place. And it really is a wretched government. It's at war with its own people in Donbass, the Donbass region in the southeast of the country. And it just revved up again about 4 or 5 days ago. And in the past couple of days, I wrote a couple of
articles on it. Killing their own people, as Obama would like to.
Killing their own people, absolutely. And they're blamed. They're blamed, and Russia is blamed for what's going on. I wrote an article today that I got out on it. It's on my blog site. People can read it. Where the Washington Post, I just very briefly at the end, I mentioned the Washington Post editorial. They blame Russian-backed, whatever they call them.
Yes, pro-Russians.
Shelling the Ukrainian forces. The Ukrainian forces are shelling the Donbass people, killing civilians, inflicting damage, and the Donbass freedom fighters are responding in self-defense, which is exactly what they have to do. And, of course, they're supported by international law, but not according to the Washington Post. The victim is the aggressor, and the aggressor is the victim, and that's the way things are portrayed in the U.S.
and that,
media.
Sure, they were protected by that agreement, which has been violated by the people who made the coup. They really don't have any reason to follow any of its dictates because it's not a legitimate government.
Well, that's right. The people in Donbass absolutely reject the government of Kiev. They want nothing to do with it. They want their own autonomy. They want to be part of Ukraine. They don't want to leave and be a separate entity. I think what they ideally love is to be part of Russia. And it's a shame that Putin, when the Crimean situation came about, and Russia did not annex Crimea. The Crimea joined Russia, and Putin simply acknowledged it and went along with it. But something like 96% of Crimeans in a national referendum, judged open, free, and fair by international observers, voted to rejoin Russia to correct a historic mistake. At the same time, Putin should have helped the people of Donbass and let them join Russia at the same time. Then all this fuss never would have happened. The war wouldn't have happened. The killing wouldn't have happened. None of this would be going on because to attack Donbass would be attacking Russia, and the lunatics in Kiev wouldn't dare do that.
Mm-hmm. On that matter of Crimea, which is so important, and by the way, there's a great essay in your book by Professor Chalcedowski, which people Canadians know him, the Global Research, wonderful website, points out that on the Crimea matter, if I get this, now I've lost track of my point, but it's really Russia's deciding to be clear on its borders and on its prerogatives as a state that has saved everybody in this situation, not accepting the kind of this New World Order idea that there's one power that makes a determination.
Absolutely, and Crimea is very strategically important for America to control Crimea, and Russia has its naval fleet based in Sevastopol, and with a long-term agreement with Ukraine. And, of course, Ukraine was part of Russia until 1991 when the dissolution took place, and Crimea was ceded to Ukraine by Nikita Khrushchev, a terrible mistake, whole thing a mistake, and that was just one of them. But it would just be devastating for Russia to have America.
And the people weren't consulted in that instance. They weren't given a chance for a referendum.
Oh, that's right. It simply happened. The deal was cut, and the point that you made very, very accurately that Gorbachev has promised that NATO would not expand east, and boy, did it ever expand east, beginning with the Clintons, and then very much so with Bush and Obama.
Mm-hmm. Apropos of Obama, one of his great flubs, and he's a rather smooth operator, but I was struck by the fact that when he was trying to make the Crimea the kind of a near war kind of issue, he was reminded by many states and individuals that in Kosovo, the U.S. took part of Serbia away from it, and someone said, and there, you know, there was a referendum in Crimea. He said, well, there was also a referendum in Kosovo. He actually made that flub. I watched him do it. I was very struck. There was no referendum in Kosovo.
Yeah, exactly. This was all arranged by America. And it's amazing the way they reinvent history, Phil. And the media repeats it like it's absolute fact. So when Trump refers to the media putting out fake news, that's exactly right. I mean, just a proliferation of fake news. Mm-hmm. He's got a couple of favorites that he likes to go after. Some of them are mine. He's very, 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 very indignant about what the New York Times and Washington Post writes about him, and also CNN. But he really should go after them all. The only one that's given him a fair shake has been Fox News.
Yeah, I want to mention too, by the way, an outstanding essay in this book is by Edward Herman and David Peterson. They go into this matter of just how this thing of fake news. I mean, American media lives and breathes fake news. I mean, for example, the Kosovo story, nobody who's returned us to the point and reminded us that there's a major military, U.S. military base now, is there not, in Kosovo?
Yes, indeed. I believe the biggest one in Europe.
I mean, that ought to be kind of giving off light or something for all of us to be reminded. That's a major move by a superpower to build a base in a country that it's declared it a country. It never actually has had any referendum, and certainly Serbia did not, has never actually conceded that is legal.
Oh, it's not legal. And throughout the 1990s, we had the Balkan Wars, which I refer to the Clintons as the Clinton co-presidency, Phil, because Hillary was very much involved in the decision-making with her husband, even though his name was on all the stuff that went out. But the two of them together were partners, and he made a big point about saying, when you elect one, you get two for the price of one. And that's exactly the way it was, but not for something good, for something pure evil. But yeah, the Balkan Wars went on throughout the 1990s. To get rid of, to break up Yugoslavia. And Russia was very, very concerned about that. It didn't do anything about it, but it went on. And the country was, in my words, raped, absolutely raped, culminating with the 1999 rape of Serbia, Kosovo, and the separation of the two. Just absolutely terrible. And yet these people like Clinton and Obama leave office with a high approval rating, showing the American people know nothing about what's going on.
Yeah. And just to wind up, let me ask you to expand or to discuss this thesis of Professor McMurtry. He says that if you follow the U.S. IMF sort of strategy of regime change and what they bring, he says they bring nothing but rape and destruction, that they don't build things. They hollow countries out when they come in. That's a very sobering and a very persuasive argument. He said, please make a list and see if you can find any contradiction to that. He talks about all the places where they go with the you know, the color revolutions and whatnot. He says they hollow the country out.
That's exactly right. I've used the expression, wherever America shows up, mass slaughter and destruction follow. That's exactly right. You can look at one country after another. When World War II ended, Phil, it looked like we finally would have an era of peace, but it wasn't to be because Truman went to war with North Korea, and the North didn't attack the South. The South attacked the North.
You cite I.F. Stone. Thank you very much.
I.F. Stone, absolutely. Hidden history of the Korean War. I have a copy of his book, a personalized, signed by him. I bought it used, and it's a treasure. I bought it for $10, Phil. I wouldn't sell it for $200.
We should put that book back in circulation. You and I should start a movement to get I.F. Stone. That book, as you point out in this book, Flashpoint Ukraine, is essential to understand what happened after World War II.
It really is. I think if you read any of these books, whether the Ukraine book, the Stone books, they don't not only tell you about the material they talk about, but they tell you, they explain U.S. foreign policy, and that's what's key to understand. Imperial policy based on permanent wars against countries threatening no one. This is what America's agenda is. America hasn't had an enemy since Japan surrendered in August 1945, and yet America's been waging continued wars against one country after another, from Harry Truman, and heaven knows what Trump is going to do, but he sent a commando group into Yemen. He's using drone bombing, so it looks like, at least to some extent, he's continuing the same thing, yeah. Which if that's the case, it's very, very disappointing.
Yeah, we have a new cowboy in the saddle.
Yeah, indeed.
Well, Stephen Lenman, Flashpoint in Ukraine, How the U.S. Drive for Hegemony Risk World War III. I assume they could just Google that title and they could order that book. Thank you very, very much for being our guest.
Oh, thank you, Phil.
It's a pleasure.